need to get a little funky.
Vibes? You know about vibes?
The mood.
The mood.
The mood.
The mood.
The mood.
The mood.
With me.
Tune in every Wednesday from 10 until 11 a.m. while I explore themes, atmospheres, or moods across genres and decades. Whether I'm scoring a scene or doing a genre deep dive, there'll be something for everyone.
I'll give you another tune to help your appetite.
The mood was made
on radio.
CFIC.
The best radio station we've ever heard.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassin. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, we'll make our first stop in Haliburton County, Ontario, where intimate partner violence is considered to be an epidemic.
A big portion of the reason for the intimate partner declarations across the board is to bring awareness to abuse, to gender-based violence against women.
To Montreal, Quebec, as a record rent increase could soon become reality. This as Quebec's tenancy board permits record rent hikes. Tenants prepare for the worst.
And that's what we're encouraging tenants to do, is to come together with their neighbors and to refuse that rent increase collectively.
Out east in Nova Scotia, he left Burma in 1967 and retired four times. Dr. Mohan Virik, now 89 years old, lives in Cape Breton. He'll soon receive the King Charles III Coronation Medal.
They were going to give me $50 a month pay and food and clothing. I said, oh, that's good. It never occurred to me that I have another choice. I worked from 7 till midnight. Every night I worked.
And a 200-foot-long Indigenous mural is revealed at the RBC Convention Center in Winnipeg in hope of inspiring dialogue and reflection.
I think art can be very important in that way, to just open up the dialogue, visually educate people.
This and a little bit more on Viewpoints, local news nationwide. This episode of Viewpoints is a rerun.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks for being with us this week. Quebec's Tenancy Board, the TAL, has set recommended rent increases at an historic high this year. Landlords following these recommendations can raise rents by up to 5.9%. The TAL recommends increases based on consumer price indexes and landlords' expenses, including management costs, maintenance, and building services. These high increases have led several tenant support groups to launch campaigns promoting education and tenants' rights. HOJO, the Off-Campus Housing and Job Resource Center, is a resource from Concordia University's student union. They are now running a series of workshops on how to refuse rent increases and negotiate with landlords. Here's Adam Innes in Montreal, Quebec.
HOJO has begun a series of rent increase clinics to help students understand their rights to refuse rent increases and negotiate with landlords. Here's HOJO's assistant director, Adia Giddings.
The tribunal announced 5.9% rent increases. That's the highest that it's basically ever been. And we will see definitely some extremely high rent increases this year.
The clinics will run on February 17th, March 12th, March 26th, and April 10th. They will cover information from how to recognize illegal rent increases to the skills needed to negotiate with landlords.
Most of the time, your landlord will send you a notice that will say you have the right to refuse and move out, or you have the right to accept and stay. But there's a third option, is to refuse and stay. A lot of times people don't know about this right. So a lot of our office programming is built around this fact of just informing people of their right to refuse.
Off campus and around Montreal, SLAM, the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union, is also raising awareness about rent increases. SLAM keeps membership in their union anonymous to protect members from dealing with harassment during ongoing conflicts with problem landlords. CJLO spoke to two of their members about why they're encouraging tenants to join them.
There's a bunch of reasons why someone might come and be interested in joining a tenants union. Like the truth is that all of us as tenants have skin in the game and have a reason to be motivated to join a union. All of us as tenants are paying rent. All of us as tenants are living in a situation where our housing is in the control of a landlord and can be taken away. So that being said, big motivators for joining the union include evictions, rent increases or being priced out of your home, landlords who are not doing repairs in the building or poor living conditions, and other people join the union out of a sense of solidarity and wanting to work together to challenge this housing system and to build alternatives together.
SLAM is an advocacy group hoping to prevent large increases like this from being recommended again and encourage what they call solidarity among the tenant class.
SLAM's approach to refusing a rent increase really focuses on collective action. And this means the first thing that you should do if you're getting a rent increase is knock on your neighbor's door, because it's almost guaranteed that they're receiving that same increase. And so when you're coming together, you're breaking down the isolation that tenants feel and that landlords are relying on. So if you're knocking on your neighbor's door and sharing your experiences of this 5.9% increase, or maybe you've got an 8% increase or a 10% increase, it gives you the opportunity to refuse together. And that's what we're encouraging tenants to do, is to come together with their neighbors and the other people who are living in other buildings that their landlords own, and to refuse that rent increase collectively. A landlord has one tenant who's refusing the rent increase. That landlord might have motivation to take that tenant to the towel. But if that landlord has 10 tenants who are refusing or 20 tenants who are refusing, you're creating a lot stronger of a barrier to that landlord being able to take all of these tenants to the towel. And that means that you have a stronger chance of successfully having that rent increase refused.
The TAL recommends increases based on consumer price indexes and a number of expenses, including management costs, maintenance, and building services. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
Adam, who also reports on an unusual statistic, an independent research group in Montreal found out that 40.8% of federal MPs are landlords. There is a growing list online of MPs and MLAs across Canada who are landlords and who invest in property. The project is led by Montreal journalist Isaac Peltz, and independent researchers from across the country are now giving him a hand to compile it. Peltz believes sitting politicians renting property could be in a conflict of interest. Check out this story on frequencynews.ca.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints.
So if you're a woman living in a rural part of Northern Ontario, you are 75% more likely to experience domestic abuse. That's what a delegation from the YWCA told members of Haliburton County Council recently. Intimate partner violence, which includes physical, mental, sexual, and financial abuse, is impacting an estimated 2,500 women in the county, according to Statistics Canada. That's why the delegation asked Haliburton Council to join a growing number of municipalities across Ontario in declaring it an epidemic. The request for the declaration came out of three feminicides, gender-based murders against women, which occurred on the same day 9 years ago. Haliburton County joined 95 other Ontario municipalities in declaring intimate partner violence an epidemic. More with Elizabeth Hoakley.
It's a staggering reality. In Haliburton County, with the challenges of rural living that includes social isolation, transportation challenges, and other barriers, an estimated 2,500 women here are experiencing domestic abuse. That figure, based on StatsCan data for population density and gender demographics, is why Haliburton County Council recently declared intimate partner violence an epidemic. Nicole Duncan, manager of both the YWCA Women's Center in Minden and the Haliburton Emergency Rural Safe Space, or HERS, says while it's an issue that may seem hidden in rural communities, the truth is women continue to endure abuse in many forms here in Haliburton County, including physical, emotional, sexual, and financial.
The reality is that rural realities, especially northern rural realities, are put women at a greater risk. So intimate partner violence is an epidemic. I can't say why we're still here. You know, I wish I could. We continue to show up every day for women and their children.
Halliburton County counselors heard from the delegation, which included Nicole Duncan, Kim Dolan, Executive Director of the YWCA Peterborough Halliburton, and Brittany McMillan, Executive Director of the Kawartha Sexual Assault Center, and learned that the request to declare intimate partner violence an epidemic here stems from a coroner's inquest into the 2015 murders of three Renfrew women by the same man who had a relationship with each of them in the past. The tragedy exposed failures in the systems meant to protect victims of intimate partner violence. Gender-based violence toward women, which includes femicide, is on the rise, and reports from the Ontario Provincial Police confirm the rates of domestic violence for women in rural communities are 75% higher than for women in urban areas. Nicole says the fact that Halliburton County supported the declaration is a step in the right direction. So far, 95 municipalities have joined in declaring intimate partner violence an epidemic.
In Halliburton County fashion, I can say with you know, some pride that they heard what we said, they listened, and they didn't deliberate. They made that declaration in real time during the delegation. And I think a big portion of the reason for the intimate partner declarations across the board is to bring awareness to abuse, to gender-based violence against women.
Nicole says the YWCA Women's Center in Minden is a judgment-free safe space where women and their children are supported. No matter where you are in your journey, there's help, encouragement, and practical assistance whenever you're ready to reach out.
This episode is a rerun.
You're tuned to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
A.K. Breton's doctor is receiving the King Charles III Coronation Medal, recognizing outstanding commitment to community and country. Dr. Mohan Virik relocated to Cape Breton from Myanmar, Burma, in 1967, devoting most of his time since then treating people from the Ekasuni First Nation. He's now 89 years old. He retired four times since 2020 and returned again last month on a part-time basis because of doctor shortages. Virik says he's humbled to receive the medal, but he says credit goes to his wife, Mabel Ann, who supports his career and understands the many hours away from home. Bill McCush in Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, spoke to Dr. Virik about his passion for medicine.
An 89-year-old Cape Breton doctor is receiving the King Charles III Coronation Medal, recognizing his many years as a physician in Cape Breton. Dr. Mohan Virik tells CKOA Radio he relocated to Cape Breton from Myanmar, then Burma, in 1967, devoting most of his time since then treating the people of Eskazoni First Nation. Virik's dream of relocating here happened when he was in grade 5, when a political science type assignment had him write a letter to the Canadian embassy, and he developed a passion to move halfway around the world, and that passion continued after studying medicine in his home region.
Over there, the education was such that you could, after graduation, work in States, Canada, USA, UK, anywhere, because we wrote many exams from those countries at the same time. So I wanted to come to Canada, and I didn't know where to go. I started writing a letter from Newfoundland, and I was going back. I finally got a letter saying that you could come and work here. They were going to give me $50 a month pay and food and clothing. I said, oh, that's good. So I didn't come with a big job or anything like that.
Virik soon became attached to the people of Eskazoni, and most of his patients throughout the years are from the First Nation. He felt a connection to the community, and he says they needed someone to watch out for them.
If you look at the early medical care for the native people, it was very compelling that you stay with them. You know, the last 50 years, 60 years I was with them, it never occurred to me that I have another choice. I worked from 7 till midnight. Every night I worked. And in the hospital, they had groups. You know, doctors would take one day or 2 days a week for call. But nobody will take me as a partner because they said, oh, native people, they come in all the time. They bug you. They're drinking. Things like that, the cliches that. So I was on call every night. And it was very compelling reason to stay with them. That's how I stayed there. Very satisfying experience to work with them.
Ferrick delivered thousands of babies whose parents are from Escazoni, and their closeness rose above a typical doctor-patient relationship.
I they just took me in as a family member. Some of them called me Papa. Somebody named the kid after you. So you become a family member with them. We had a sign in Escazoni, no patient after 2 o'clock, but we were open till 10 or 11 at night time. But it was just kind of a love affair with the people there.
Ferrick continued treating the people of Escazoni, and the bond developed throughout the decades. Then one day, about 5 years ago, he tried to hang up the stethoscope, but it didn't last.
It's kind of funny. It's a very profitable thing to retire and come back, because when you say you're retiring, they give you some presents like a meal, a ticket for Boston Pizza or something like that. And then I finish up all those, and then I go back to work and start again. Try to retire 4 times. And each time, I retired actually in 2000. I said I must retire. But then the patients call you and they come home. And in the end, you say, oh, better for me to go to work.
Of the 4 times Ferrick retired, recently he returned to medicine again, because he says he is still in good shape and his absence left a void in local healthcare.
So now I retired again. I think in January I retired. But I still, God has given me health, and I love what I'm doing. So now I go to primary care. I work 2 days there. And then whatever I can do from the phone, I do that. That's how my schedule is.
But it's not just patients who are reaching out to Dr. Ferrick. The government recently sent an email to him notifying him that his nearly 70 years of treating patients with a focus on First Nations is being recognized with the King Charles III Coronation Medal. He says he overlooked the message in his inbox, not realizing the significance.
You know, I got this email on 10 days ago, but I didn't know what it was. I didn't open it. So just a few days ago, I opened it and I thought I looked very arrogant that I didn't reply back. So I did that yesterday. But it's just more than that is the love that you get from your patients, right? I'm a doctor who's just doing what I'm supposed to do. You know, I'm not doing anything.
Meanwhile, Ferrick says there would be no medal without the support of his wife, Mabel Ann Ferrick. He says she supported his dedication to medicine so much that even their wedding day was marked with him going to work.
Actually, if any accomplishment is, she sacrificed, because I was never home. I left at 7 and I came back at 11 every day. She raised the kids and she never complained. The day of the marriage, I was on call that night. And I was a little shy telling my people that I'm going to get married, and I thought they'll tease me. So I was on call, and I took the call. So I took 3 hours off and got married and came back to work. And then that night, I think I went at 9 o'clock to St. Rita's. We went to honeymoon to Bedeck. So I came to the hospital. There was a child had a crib death. So I came there and I stayed there till about 3 o'clock in the morning. When I went back to the hotel where we were staying, I see a lot of cars in that motel, and I said, "Wonder why there are so many cars." So since I wasn't there, she called her friends, and they were having a pizza party. I robbed her from, you know, all those things, but she never complained. He was a rock on my life, you know. She just accepted there that she let me do all the silly things I did. 67 years, I think, we are married. And she's the rock of my life.
How they met? Well, she helped him with a delicate procedure at the Glace Bay Hospital when they were both young healthcare professionals.
So we were going to do a circumcision. And in med school, they teach you all the big things, but they forget simple things like how to remove a toenail and how to do a circumcision. So I had never done that. So she was in, she worked in the obstetric department. So I asked her, I said, you know, I've never done circumcision, would you stay with me? She said, yeah. So we did the circumcision at that time together. And I think things just sparked from there. And but a year and a half later, we were married, and we have married since 67 years now.
Ferrick says his roots are here on the island of Cape Breton, and this is where he says he wants to stay. One day while flying high above Canada back to the island from out west, he made a wish and got a divine reply.
Coming one day from Winnipeg after a meeting, and the plane started shaking up and down, and everyone started praying. So I looked at the window and I said, Jesus, God, the only thing I have asked you that I die in Cape Breton, and this is not Cape Breton. So I thought you had accepted that promise that I could die in Cape Breton. So that's the love for this country.
Dr. Ferrick will receive the Coronation Medal sometime in the spring. For the Local Journalism Initiative, Bill McCush.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
This episode is a rerun. A new 200-foot-long Indigenous mural is revealed at the RBC Convention Centre in Winnipeg in hope of inspiring dialogue and reflection. The mural was painted by Indigenous artist Justine Brou. The mural, entitled Returning to Our Roots, tells a story of Indigenous culture, nature, and renewal. Brou says she wanted to explore how the loss of community and culture has caused many Indigenous and non-Indigenous people to become lost. Murals weren't how Brou got her artistic start. She started as a tattoo artist, only transitioning to murals after tattoo shops had to close during the pandemic. Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Indigenous artist Justine Brou believes art is healing, and the 200-foot mural they created outside Winnipeg's RBC Convention Center could be a catalyst for conversation and community.
I think art can be very important in that way, to just open up the dialogue, visually educate people and teach people in a way that is easier, I think, and more natural to come across, as opposed to writing a public announcement or forcing people to read a book or something, you know, like it just gets the interest going a little more, and then we can move into that education portion.
The mural titled Returning to Our Roots tells a story of Indigenous culture, nature, and renewal. Brou wanted to explore how the loss of community and culture has caused many Indigenous and non-Indigenous to become lost. The mural embodies themes of balance and connection to the earth, featuring the four seasons, sacred medicines, eagles, and bison. Brou says it serves as a reminder of the importance of reconnecting with nature and each other.
I really wanted it to kind of be, as you walk down the street, like a journey through the season. So the first panel starts at spring, and it starts with an eagle, and the eagle's very large. He's like holding the land. And, you know, eagles in the seven teachings represent love. They're also the bird that's closest to creator, the animal that's closest to creator. So they're very like highly regarded in terms of like a spiritual animal. So that kind of starts off our mural. And there's like the colors are a little bit more muted in the spring panel. You know, you can tell that life hasn't fully come back from winter yet.
The second panel of summer features vibrant colors, cedar, a muskrat, and a snapping turtle, representing the creation story. On the fall panel, the colors darken, showcasing three bison, sage, and the cycle of the moon. Winter includes sweetgrass, a moon, polar bears, and the northern lights, with more muted tones. Symmetry is another important element of Brou's art.
When you're looking at the mural, if you can look at it straight on, the sun and the moon are mirrored. Symmetry is something I put in a lot of my murals. If you look at most of my artwork, it's almost perfectly mirrored, or half night, half day. And I really enjoy getting balanced through in that kind of visual way.
Murals weren't how Prue got their artistic start. They started as a tattoo artist, only transitioning to murals after tattoo shops had to close during the pandemic. With an empty classroom, Prue's mother, who teaches Indigenous studies, asked if they could come and paint. Seeing a post of that mural on Instagram, a teacher at the Louis Riel Arts and Technology Center, where Prue had taken classes, reached out to commission a mural at their school. This quickly turned into a full-time passion.
Now it's almost, I mostly do that full-time. Like, I'm pretty much always painting some type of mural. Yeah. So the wait list of the murals got kind of long. I think at one point I had like over 15 schools on it. I think I have eight or 10 now that I'm still needing to work through.
Returning to Our Roots is Prue's most recent work. The four-piece mural between Carlton and Edmonton Street includes didactic panels on the pillars separating each image. These describe the symbolism and significance of each visual element. Prue notes they will add a QR code once the winter weather improves that describes the image and their meaning in even greater detail. Through all their mediums, Prue says they hope to spark conversations, inspire others to embrace creativity, and foster deeper connections between people, culture, and nature. I'm Ryan Funk.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
We now pause to take a breath of fresh air and turn to the skies as the annual Prince George Christmas bird count held between December 14th and January 5th came back with big numbers. This year's count smashed previous records, running like clockwork since 1968 and held this year on January 5th. Never has the event seen this many birds. A total of 19,641 birds were counted, smashing the previous year's number of some 6,500 birds. However, 11,000 of those identified were Bohemian waxwings. Here's part of Ian Gregg's conversation with Kathy Antoniadzi of the Prince George Naturalist Club in British Columbia.
This year we found lots of birds, but the weather was good. We had very good effort. We had a lot of people out looking, and so there's lots of food, and there were good numbers of redpolls. Some of it's encouraging. Three woodpecker species set all-time high counts, so that's encouraging. Flicker numbers, the northern flickers, the woodpecker that's common here in town, numbers are up, and they've been trending up. There were lots of owls around. There have been lots of owls around the airport. So we found 5 species of owls, I think. Oh, we had lots of robins. That was interesting. Just because we found lots of birds doesn't mean that the actual numbers of birds are up. They were up here for this winter on that day.
We'll take any good news we can these days, Kathy. Thanks to Ian Gregg for that excerpt. That's it for us this week. Thanks to our journalists Ryan Funk, Elizabeth Oakley, Bill McCouche, Adam Ennis, and Ian Gregg. To our national editors Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox, Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm Boris Hassan, your host and producer. It was great to have you with us this week again. And until the next, ciao.
Curtis Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Tech and Talk. This week, we're joined by Joe Borsato, a final year PhD candidate in the Department of History at Queen's. He is an expert in Indigenous history, and empire, and he's here today to speak about his experience in history, his research, and much more. Professor Borsato, Joe Borsato, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much, Sam.
Super. So just before we started recording, we asked you about how you became a PhD candidate. And I was wondering if you could just explain that again for the greater audience, because it's sort of a rare thing. I was reading this statistic earlier. Only about 8% of people who do an undergrad in history go on to a master's, and then of that, a very few percent go on to get a PhD. So if you wouldn't mind just describing it in general, that'd be great.
Sure. It's been a sort of weird, meandering journey. Always kind of is, I think. So I started off in undergrad at the University of Calgary. I'm originally from British Columbia. I'm from sort of central British Columbia. It's the territory of the Tsleil-Waututh people, the Tsilhqot'in people, Deketh people. So, but I didn't want to live like in the Lower Mainland for university because it's even that long ago, it was expensive, too expensive. So I went to Calgary, I started off in a lot of like STEM fields. I did chemistry, biology, physics, all that sort of fun stuff. And it was sort of like unquestionably my sort of best scores and grades and stuff were in those fields. And everyone was encouraging me to go into those fields. That's sort of what I was going to do. But at a certain point, I took some history and classics courses. And, I thought that was just a sort of different intellectual enterprise. So, we'd read things like different accounts of the Roman Empire, like Cassius Dio and Tacitus. And you're like, well, which one of these is correct? They're writing about the same thing around roughly the same time. So like one of them has to be right and one of them has to be wrong, right? You'd ask this to the professor and the professor would be like, well, what do you think? And, and why? And it's like, oh, these are very different kinds of questions. And, very big questions that people, are still asking. And so I was like, okay, so I have to do this, right? Like even no matter what happens afterwards, after undergrad, I have to do this while I'm here. So I ended up, I ended up doing some research assistant work for one professor who took me under his wing, which involved going to Europe at one point to do research in the National Archives of the United Kingdom, which was really fascinating. You get to like flip through like old archival documents from the 16th century, which is really fun. And, it's the sort of thing that it just brought me a lot of satisfaction. So anyway, really enjoyed that. Ended up doing a master's, at the University of Alberta, just up the road, and for a year there, and then for like financial reasons, I took a couple of years off to work. I worked in the nonprofit sector. I worked in a museum. I worked in a sustainability organization. I enjoyed the last one quite a bit, but I was very sort of dissatisfied with the public history museum sort of sector for a number of reasons. It just didn't bring me the same kind of satisfaction as I got mm-hmm. from doing research. And then also, I had something I really wanted to say. to the research that I just didn't feel was being said in the historiography, in the scholarship on the history of Indigenous peoples and empires. And that was a big sort of driving force for me. So after a couple of years in nonprofits, I applied for a lot of different PhD programs, and Queen's ended up being the best fit for me for a variety of reasons. And I've been here for the last 4 and a bit years, which has been which has been great. I've been able to do a lot of that research. I've published a couple peer-reviewed articles and that sort of fun stuff. So yeah, it's been there's a lot more I still want to do on that, but yeah, so that's sort of what got me here. And I mean, the other thing I guess I should add that drove me to do this is when I didn't do very much teaching in undergrad and in the master's, but when I was in nonprofits, I did a lot of leadership stuff. I ran a nonprofit for a while, which was a whole other experience. But the part about that that I enjoyed was working with people and being in a sort of leadership position, directing the nonprofit's projects and helping, you know, people overcome their own obstacles in their work. And so I thought, well, this is kind of like teaching. Mm-hmm. So that was the other sort of thing where I was like, I want to get more experience in that. I want to do that more. And so that was another sort of motivating factor as well.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And for those of you who don't know, it's not very common to publish 2 peer-reviewed articles, even more than that as well. And while you're a doctoral student, so quite frankly, that's remarkable if that gives you any idea of how academically inclined Joe Versado is. But on a separate note, I was going to ask, though, did a lot of the things that you learned and the skills you developed in working in the nonprofit sector translate to writing a thesis?
Well, first of all, that's flattering. Thank you very much. There's a third one on the way. It should be out later this year. A third article. Writing a dissertation, it's not so much about, I mean, it is a lot about how many words you can get on a page. But it's also so much about planning and so much about how much you can anticipate work ahead of time and plan for it and allocate your hours so you don't like get overworked or get overwhelmed and get burned out. I would say that aspect of working in nonprofits, especially nonprofits, like you get this experience from working in any kind of private sector or even public sector work, but working in nonprofits, which is very sort of on the small scale nonprofits, and this was a small nonprofit, a couple small nonprofits, there's so much planning that you have to do, you know, in terms of doing budgets, in terms of doing team building with staff. I worked with a lot of summer students, for instance, in museums and in sustainability organizations. And so there was a lot of like hands-on interpersonal time that you had to plan for, and there's a lot of stuff you couldn't plan for, and you had to plan for that too, which is kind of funny, right? Never book yourself for more than like 75% of your time. So a lot of stuff like that was very helpful when it came to doing a PhD, because doing a PhD is very much just being put in the sea and being told you now have to sail it. And it's like, oh, okay. I'll try my best, I guess. Right. But having some sort of like knowledge of like, well, okay, how long did it take me to write a chapter? Okay. Well then how do I scale that? Right. Mm-hmm. To a whole dissertation. Being able to sort of think that through and plan ahead, I think is like really important and has definitely saved me a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, surely. I can only imagine. I mean, I'm writing an undergraduate thesis now, which is significantly less, and even that requires a decent bit of planning.
Yeah, that's hard because it's the first time you've ever done something like that, right? When I first, when I wrote my undergraduate thesis, that was like, oh my goodness. Like, I didn't have like the closest thing, obviously, which, you know, experience is writing an essay in a like for a term paper or something, right? Which isn't the same size or the necessarily the same amount of like thought has to be put into it, right? Mm-hmm. More thought has to be put into a dissertation. So yeah, no, it's harder the first time you do something, right? Mm-hmm. Once you, like when I did my master's thesis, that was a lot like less painful process. Right. So yeah, so good for you for doing that though.
Thank you.
That's really good experience.
Yeah, and on the topic of thesis, I've just generally, yours is about Anglo-Indigenous relations, specifically as it relates to the American continent. So I guess it's almost like an Atlantic, you know, perspective as well. But would you like to just speak about that a little bit in particular?
Sure. Yeah, it's the sort of thing where not many historians look at the history of Anglo-Indigenous relations in an oceanic context, in the context of like the hemisphere or of the Atlantic Ocean. So, you know, a lot of historians will just study the history of Virginia, you know, the history of New England, the colonies there, when it relations with Powhatan or Wampanoag peoples. And so I was very dissatisfied with that, partly because it's just been done so much. So I was struggling to find anything new to say about that. I also just sort of have other interests besides that. So my dissertation examines Anglo-Indigenous relations in the late 16th and early 17th centuries in northern South America, so what, you know, the English call Guiana, or what the Arawak people, the Locono people there, call Gurinoco, which just means the land of many waters, because there's a lot of rivers there. But also the Caribbean, which is very underrated as a region to study. I do talk a little bit about Virginia and New England, but also Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, and the Hudson Bay. So this is a sort of very kind of big project, but it's also sort of bound by a very specific time period. And what I've sort of been trying to argue in the dissertation is that Indigenous peoples challenged the English Empire really from the outset in both material terms, so in terms of like warfare and that sort of stuff, but also in emotional terms. And so this is something that's often not discussed and that I felt I really had to say about the work, about this research, is that Indigenous peoples made very overt expressions of their own political societies, in the sense that they were civil societies and could govern themselves and possess territory. And these expressions really created an atmosphere of insecurity in the early English Empire. And I find this in various forms in all of the contexts that I look at. And so this is sort of my intervention in the field. If you want me to get down into a specific example, you know, there's an incident in Virginia, for instance, where in 1609, just 2 years after the Jamestown settlement was established, the first permanent English settlement in the Americas, where the Virginia Company, which was the joint stock corporation that was chartered for colonizing in Virginia, they wrote a memorandum in 1609, shortly after making being engaged with the Powhatan polity, which is the large sort of paramount chiefdom, as it's sometimes called in the region, sort of loose alignment of Algonquin speaking peoples. And anyway, the Virginia Company says in this memorandum that they must abstain from making a claim to the land in the Chesapeake, in the Chesapeake Bay area in Virginia. And they explicitly say on account of what they call the naturals, on account of Indigenous peoples, on account of the Powhatans. And so this to me is a really sort of telling memorandum, because it says like they don't have the kind of language, they don't have the capacity to make a claim on this territory, which I think is a really remarkable thing when you think about what comes later, which is just, you know, four centuries of European empires sort of unabashedly claiming Indigenous territory. And so there was something going on here, right, where the Powhatan expressions, and I track a lot of these in the archives and printed sources, expressions of their power, expressions of their possession of territory. And so this is, you know, I think in many ways this memorandum is a response to the Powhatans. And I think this is an important moment where Indigenous peoples are expressing their rights, their abilities to be regarded among the community of nations. And I think this is a, you know, it's just a really important moment. Now, this sort of thing where things change, eventually the sort of the English develop a certain amount of confidence in engaging with Indigenous peoples after several years of having settlements in the Americas. So this does change, but I think it's still an important context that informs the events of early English colonization.
Oh, that's super fascinating. And you said, though, that in general as well, like the emotional element, people don't really study in history. Is there a particular reason for that? Is it because it's just harder to decipher through the archives? Or is it because they just saw it as something that wasn't of significance until recently when we started adding more dimensions to the historical scope?
That's an interesting question. I think there are a number of reasons, one of which is probably, to a certain extent, historical training, like in the way that everything in history departments everywhere, in as far as I know them anyway, is everyone works in a field. You know, someone does Canadian history, another person does American history, another person does, you know, Latin American or South American history. And that, you know, people don't talk to each other. They don't go to each other's conferences. They don't read each other's work. So to an extent, I think everyone's kind of siloed off. And I also think that, like people who study more sort of like material history of what Indigenous people did in the past, versus the sort of more emotional history, I think those are very separate fields as well. You know, there hasn't really this. Yeah, I think people just don't put these things together by virtue of just how the academy is organized. Unfortunately, I think. I'm going to have to think about that a little bit more, as I think there's probably more to it than that. Mm-hmm. But that's my sort of initial response.
I wasn't actually expecting that, but it does make sense, though, because the more I think about it, it is kind of rare to see professors go cross departmental in their readings and research, or departmental through different fields.
Yeah, I think that applies to other things too. Science and everything's also got the same problems for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, like even fields that you would think would be in conversation with each other. It just doesn't happen. It's bizarre and I don't think good for knowledge.
And if you don't mind, maybe we could just speak about your two articles that are currently published.
Sure.
And so the first one I have in front of me right now is the one that you published in Global Intellectual History, Contra Eis Gentium, the Mendoza-Drake Dispute and English Legal Arguments for Empire in 1580-1585. So this, if I'm not mistaken, that was part of your undergraduate thesis in Calgary. It touched on the topic. Like, is this the same article as it was when you wrote the thesis, or is it more expanded now?
It's definitely more expanded now. My honors thesis was not that polished.
I was going to say, this is probably the best honors thesis I've ever read.
That's very generous of you to say. My honors thesis was a lot rougher than this. A lot, I stress, a lot rougher than this. But yes, it's the same research that informs it. So this is based on some of that, like that first sort of archival experience I got. I went to the UK. So this is many years ago when I did the research, it was a lot of work for me as an undergrad. And I sort of really wanted, when I was in the PhD, to sort of, okay, I really want to justify all that work I did, and I think anyone really who writes an honors thesis should consider, you know, doing this, in consultation with your professors, obviously. But, you know, I think I really wanted to put it out there, just to sort of justify all that time and effort. And it really wasn't a ton of time and effort in order to clean it up, make it more presentable. And the peer review process is a lot of work, but it still wasn't like an immense amount more work than just writing the original piece. So, you know, the bulk of the work had been done. Mm-hmm. So I was really, I really want to get this out there. I mean, it's a bit of an, it's a bit of an odd piece, I guess, in a way, because it's trying to chart a very particular aspect of empire, in the context of early English engagement with especially the Taino people in the Caribbean, and various indigenous, nations on the west coast of North America. So it's a very sort of, it's charting a change in imperial discourse that occurs in the 1580s, amidst Francis Drake, this gallivanting pirate who goes around the world. This is the second circumnavigation, recorded circumnavigation of the world. And from this event, Spain and England get into an argument about, you know, him claiming territory in the Americas for England. And it's this really sort of moment where the English crown steps in and really tries to argue for its own claims vis-a-vis the Spanish. And there's a whole bunch of interesting things that come up in that debate. Number of, you know, the English use arguments that the sea is open for everyone to trade in and to go places and claim land that, you know, is supposedly not held by anyone. So it's an interesting sort of moment of that, that sort of whole discourse. And there's more that could be said about that, but I won't sort of belabor the point. But yeah, no, it's an interesting little episode, I guess.
Oh, it is super fascinating. And I think one of the things I took away from the article itself is that within the debate itself, the notion of like ius gentium terms sort of became a, like an acceptable argument to be made in a European expansionist context. Is that like roughly fair?
That's very fair. Yeah. That's a very good, very, very good way of putting it. I've always sort of, you know, there's this angle of on like international law really is what the ius gentium is. It's this, you know, this precursor to, you know, the law of nations is really what it was called at the time. And it's, yeah, it's the precursor sort of to international law and, is at, you know, there are a few other incidents before this where there are debates about like, you know, having the right to trade on, you know, off the coast of Africa. The English have arguments with the Portuguese about this, in the 16th century, in the 1560s, I believe. So this is a sort, this isn't necessarily the first incident where these debates come up, but it is one where I think the rhetoric gets really hyped up. So, yeah. And it informs a lot of like, the sort of at the very end of the article, I talk a little bit about Richard Hakluyt, or Hakluyt, as his name is probably supposed to be pronounced, who, you know, draws on Drake's experience to inform a lot of the rhetoric around colonization. So, yeah, it's a sort of, I'm trying to track a lot of these discussions because, I mean, there's a lot of discourse today, for instance, about what role international law has in, you know, some countries interfering in other countries' affairs, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's an it's sort of one of the things that drew me to doing that research originally was like, well, how does this inform empire? Mm-hmm. How does international law inform empires very early on? So, yeah, and I've always sort of had a penchant for studying people like Francisco de Vitoria, who's a ius gentium theorist, and Alberico Gentili, who's another ius gentium theorist, and they come up a lot in this whole thing. So, yeah, I've just it's something I find interesting, and it's not really part of like my PhD research per se, but it is something that I was interested in undergrad and have sort of informed some of what I've been doing since then. So,
yeah. It seems super interesting. It just occurred to me that you must also know a decent bit of Latin as well. Through reading through all these documents,
I have spent like 500 hours learning Latin or something like that. Yeah, it's a
tough language.
Well, yeah,
a little bit.
You had a great Latin teacher in high school.
Well, yeah, I mean, reading Latin is one thing, but to speak it is definitely
I don't
pretty difficult.
Pretend to speak it in any meaningful way.
Yeah,
It's a lot of work. Yeah.
I mean, in your article, I noticed that you referenced a couple times that they were using like Roman like laws and stuff. I thought that was interesting because they're still going digging all the way back to trying to, you know, still find justification. And, you know, they were, you know, using the Roman Empire as an example, I guess.
Oh, yeah. The classical tradition is really important. So important. Can't be understated. Even like I know it's sort of this like it's the 16th century. So it's like the late Renaissance kind of thing. So there's obviously a lot of like, you know, pulling on the old Roman and Greek tradition, but I think the classical tradition doesn't really ever go away. So yeah. I think it's one of these things that's, I think it's really important. Very good of you to have a Latin teacher in high school.
It's
very rare. Yeah. but good for you. That's awesome.
Yeah. And if we may, just for the sake of time as well, talk a bit about the other article. This one, I assume, comes out of your doctoral research, just based off what I read and you were telling, and based off what you're telling us about research, but this in the Journal of History, we should sow and reap in peace Algonquin foundations of colonial insecurity in the correspondence of the Virginia Company. And in this one, it's like I'm assuming it's sort of like an abstract of part of your thesis. if I understood correctly from when you were explaining your thesis?
Yeah, so it's adjacent to the thesis. Adjacent, absolutely, okay. Yeah. It's not like a chapter or anything, okay. But it's adjacent to the thesis research. It's some stuff that just couldn't fit into the dissertation. So, yeah, I'm flattered that you both read my articles, I have to say.
Oh, they're really interesting.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, so this is adjacent to the dissertation. So this kind of came out of a special issue of the Journal of History. They wanted to do a piece on genocide in the past. I don't know, maybe there's something wrong with me, but like when someone first sort of told me about this, I was like, oh, well, it'd be really cool to have, you know, someone who writes about like the history of destruction and how, you know, the destruction of nations and how that informs, like how that was informed by the history of empire, how empire informs writing about destruction and violence. I sort of discovered, you know, after I actually submitted to this and, you know, we went through the peer review process and it eventually got published, that I was the only person in the special issue who wrote about anything other than like the 20th century or late 19th century. So I was like, oh, well, I'm kind of glad I actually submitted for that in a way. So I didn't necessarily take this article from the perspective of like, how was early English colonization genocide, which I think is a fairly straightforward question to ask. I wanted to ask it more in the sense of, well, how did indigenous people's actions shape contemporary, like 17th century discourses about empire and the destruction of nations? So I kind of flipped it a little bit in a way that I don't necessarily know a lot of people would. But so I did that. And, you know, I was really interested in looking at how various Algonquin peoples, mostly the Powhatans in Virginia, but number of other nations in that region, what they did in order to challenge the English, especially like in the emotional terms, right? So there are a couple case studies in there. There's, you know, from the title of it, there's one Powhatan messenger who goes to the English very early on within the first couple months of the colony. And, you know, it's not clear if he ever says this explicitly, but the record indicates that they agreed, they being the Powhatan messenger and the Virginia Company colonists, agreed that they should sow and reap in peace, so that they should, you know, they should accept one another's presence and that they should just continue to, you know, harvest crops together. Mm-hmm. So this is a sort of, you know, indication of the Powhatans, you know, if you look at it from their perspective, we're really trying to bring stability to these newcomers who just showed up. Like, this is our territory. We will sow and reap in peace together, right? This is a sort of very overt effort on their part to bring the English into their fold. There's a couple other incidents when the English do eventually break with this promise a few years later, that one messenger, Okanidge, he's not Powhatan, but he's from another Algonquin nation. He comes to them and brings a message and says, you know, like, if you try and dispossess us, we'll just move. And he has this whole speech in there that I thought was really interesting. So I, you know, I track that and I look at the, how that changes the sort of dynamic at play. And so the sort of the, and there's a few other examples like that throughout the piece, but it's sort of really trying to get at that, the insecurities at play in early colonization and how that then informs broader writings about destruction of nations and then ultimately genocide with Raphael Lemkin, who coined the term.
Interesting. And what would you say was the biggest factor that led to the dissolution of English insecurity as it comes to indigenous Anglo relations?
So that's also a very good question. Probably the most important thing would be just the passage of time. So the experience of having colonies that don't just fail within a year or two, mm-hmm. for the English Empire, because a lot of they did try to colonize many times.
Well, the most predominant one I can think of is we read about last year when I was in your class, but Roanoke, yeah. For one, sticks out quite a bit.
Exactly. Yeah. So Roanoke is perfect example of a failed colony in the 16th century. There were many more in the early 17th century. Even there was one that was contemporary to the Virginia Company. It was even called the Virginia Company of Plymouth. So not the Virginia Company of London, but they tried to establish a colony in northern, what is now northern Maine, in Abenaki territory. And that lasted a year, right? And established at virtually the same time as